Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. So if you're following the impeachment news closely and you want to understand how it works and why, my next guest wrote the book. It was 2 years ago that Harvard Law professor and former Obama administration official Cass Sunstein published Impeachment, A Citizen's Guide. So we'll talk about some of today's impeachment news with him, but also get into some deeper cuts, like where the head-scratching phrase high crimes and misdemeanors came from, and what people like Madison and Hamilton and Jefferson were thinking when the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence were being written. Explaining some of those things, he wrote an op-ed in the Times, in the New York Times, 2 weeks ago, called The Best Way to Determine If Trump Deserves Impeachment. Cass Sunstein joins us along with Henry Greenberg, president of the New York State Bar Association. They'll be doing an event tomorrow night, Impeachment, A Guide to the Legal Process and Its History. That's 6 p.m. tomorrow, October 15th, at the Fordham University Law School. Professor Sunstein, by the way, is a real public intellectual, not just an impeachment geek, having written books with titles like Infotopia, How Many Minds Produce Knowledge, and After the Rights Revolution, Free Markets and Social Justice is another one, and more. And he served in President Obama's first term as administrator of the White House Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs. So, Cass, welcome back. Henry, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be here.
Just to ground this in where I think we are, tell me if you agree with this premise, Cass. We already know that Trump, quote, did it. He asked Ukraine's president to interfere in our election and at least implied extortion or a bribe, at least implied it, with a White House meeting and U.S. military aid. No meeting, no U.S. military aid without the election interference. And so the overarching question is inevitably going to become, is this bad enough for removal from office, or is it just bad enough to be criticized? How much do you agree or disagree with that premise of where we are?
I think I wouldn't sign on to all of that. Not that I disagree with it, but we're in the midst of finding facts, and we have a transcript of a conversation. It's troubling. Exactly the right interpretation of the transcript, I think, deserves the initials TBD. The interpretation you gave on it, which is being given by a lot of people, is, I think, the least favorable to the president, and it might turn out to be true, but given the gravity of the impeachment proceeding and the removal sanction, probably best to take a deep breath and be, I'd be a little more cautious on the facts.
There's the transcript, but there are also those text messages. How much do they or do they not close the door on, quote, he did it?
Well, he did something. So there is an it that he definitely did. Whether he did it in the form of quid pro quo, I think it's fair to the tens of millions of people who voted for the president and to the majesty, really, of the impeachment sanction to be a little hesitant to say that what he did was to say, you're not going to get the money unless you investigate my political opponent. There are some not very good signs for the president in what you described, but whether we have that exactly, I think to be inquisitive rather than decisive in this context is probably what we the people should be.
You wrote in your New York Times op-ed that the idea of impeachment originated in England, but became thoroughly Americanized in colonial times. Want to tell us some of that origin story?
Yeah, this is a lost part of American history, and if you want to know something about American exceptionalism, it's right here, and it's plenty inspiring, that in the early days of abuse of monarchical authority, the American colonists started impeaching the agents of the king. And we use this old idea of high crimes and misdemeanors, an old English idea that had fallen almost entirely into disuse. And we, our predecessors, started saying, you know what, you're abusing your authority. You're not respecting civil liberties. You're not respecting limits on what your office legitimately includes. We're going to impeach you. And the kind of bravery and ingenuity in that, I think, have marked our country since. And it turned impeachment into a technique of self-rule. It made the idea of republicanism, as opposed to monarchical rule, the idea of we the people, was basically built into the core of impeachment in the middle of the 18th century, before bullets were fired in Concord and Lexington.
So you trace the idea of impeachment in American law and politics not to the Constitution, 1789, but to the Declaration of Independence, 1776.
Yes. So if you want to understand what impeachment is all about, reading Jefferson's Declaration is a really good idea. It reads like articles of impeachment. And you know, I've studied the Constitution for a long, long time. But this part of our history, I and I think almost all constitutional scholars were clueless about. Once you see what happened, starting actually in 1642, when the colonists started using impeachment, all the way up to middle and late 18th century, then you can see that the Declaration of Independence, it is tracking the idea of impeachment, and you can learn that it's not about unnecessarily committing crimes, though serious crimes certainly are impeachable. It's about terrible misuses of your authority, abusing the limited authority that a leader has by virtue of being a leader. It's limited authority.
My guest, if you're just joining us, Harvard Law Professor Cass Sunstein, author of the book published 2 years ago called Impeachment, A Citizen's Guide, and Henry Greenberg, president of the New York State Bar Association. They'll be doing an event together tomorrow night at 6 at the Fordham University Law School, and we'll get to Henry in a minute. But listeners, we also invite your phone calls at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Cast the phrase, high crimes and misdemeanors, came from the founding father, George Mason, you remind us. What was the context and what did he mean? Because people really don't know what he meant.
Okay, this could easily be a TV show or a movie that in Philadelphia, that is the delegates to the Constitutional Convention, agree to create a very powerful executive. And that is quite controversial. Many people are saying, you're going back to a monarchy. You're creating an elective king. And that's a quote, by the way. Then the question is, how are we going to make this tolerable, given a lot of people lost their lives, to ensure that we don't have any kind of monarchy, elective or not? And the idea basically was impeachment. And then the question was, what standard? And it's floating through different linguistic formulations in Philadelphia until in the last moments it's limited to treason and bribery. That's it. And Mason says, look, there are a lot of great and dangerous offenses that don't count. That's his words, great and dangerous offenses. And he says we should substitute a word, maladministration. And that word, maladministration, much broader, it actually had its own history in the United States after the Revolution. And James Madison replies, that's vague. Even though it has a history, Madison knew, maladministration could make the president basically dependent on the House and the Senate. Can't do that. And then Mason says, okay, got you, high crimes and misdemeanors. And that word to us maybe seems vague, but to them it's a little like the word motor vehicles to us. That is, it has a very concrete meaning. It's basically saying what Mason says, let's track what we've been doing basically for the last 50 years, where egregious abuses of authority are the grounds for impeachment. And those words, which were quite familiar in the period, were designed specifically to make sure it's not a political decision. You can't get rid of the president because you think he's a fool. You can get rid of him because he's done one of an assortment of things. They might be crimes, they might not be. They might be violations of civil liberty that helped create the American Republic.
Today we use the word misdemeanor to indicate a minor offense. How did George Mason mean it?
He meant a bad act, and not a limited bad act like, you know, jaywalking or screaming in the city on a crowded street at 2 in the morning. That would be disorderly conduct. He meant a bad act, and Hamilton clearly explained this to the state of New York in the Federalist Papers. He said this is, you know, an abuse of public authority. That's what we're talking about here. And then in Massachusetts, where the revolution started, there was reference to abuse of civil liberties, violation of freedom. And then in Virginia, there was talk about lying to Congress to get a treaty. And in Virginia, which was really important for ratification, Madison himself talked about abuse of the pardon power. And all of these examples I've given are, you know, uncontested examples. People clearly thought, you abuse the pardon power, you can be impeached. You violate civil liberties, you can be impeached. You lie to the Senate to get a treaty passed, that's an impeachable offense.
But let me press you a little bit on whether this wasn't vague, because you said it wasn't vague. I was surprised that you wrote it was not a grant of discretion to the House of Representatives, but it kind of seems like it, the way it has played out with Clinton, with this, maybe even with Nixon.
Completely. So you're right in terms of how it's played out, but in terms of how the framework was meant to work, it was meant to ensure, look, you dislike the president, you think he's a creep, you think he's a fool, you think he's a danger, you can't impeach for those reasons. And Madison was very clear about that. That's all over the ratification debates. That suggests that the Clinton impeachment was an unconstitutional impeachment. That is, Clinton did some things that were almost certainly crimes, maybe we can even say were certainly crimes, and they weren't good, but they aren't the kind of thing that created the American Revolution or the impeachment clause. With respect to Nixon, we did have a much more responsible process in which the process played out, your correct term, in a way that was highly attentive to what the Constitution calls for. In terms of the history, high crimes and misdemeanors to us might look like a kind of punt to the House. That's exactly what it wasn't meant to do. It was meant to say that there are lots of things that are maladministration. They aren't impeachable, and it was meant to say there are other things that are abuses of authority, and we can talk about the president if you like. We certainly have some candidates there, but there are abuses of authority, like not respecting freedom of speech or freedom of association, and those are clearly impeachable. Those are misdemeanors in the form of bad acts against the background against which those words were put in the Constitution.
Again, Cass Sunstein will be in conversation tomorrow night at 6 at the Fordham Law School with Henry Greenberg, president of the New York State Bar Association and partner at Greenberg Traurig, the law firm, who is also with us. Henry, thanks for your patience, first of all. I got through some stuff with Cass there. And what's your interest here? Does the New York State Bar Association have a position on impeaching Trump?
We do not. Our interest is to educate the public and the profession and policymakers about the kinds of things Professor Sunstein is the preeminent expert on in the nation. There is, one hears on cable news over and over, it's taken a form of conventional wisdom that the impeachment process is a political process. You hear it over and over and over again. What Professor Sunstein's book illustrates so very, very well is that that's not true. It is not purely a political process. It's a process prescribed by the Constitution. It is a process that's limited and guided by past precedent and constitutional principles and analysis. And in these times, that kind of objective, neutral, serious, deep thinking, the kind of judicious approach to these issues that you just heard Professor Sunstein demonstrate is precisely what's needed. You know, there's an ancient curse, may you live in interesting times. Well, I think I can say without fear of contradiction, we live in interesting times.
So you're saying that impeachment is a hybrid of the legal and the political?
Well, what I'm saying is that it is certainly a process that is administered by elected officials, politicians, but I think Professor Sunstein's point, and he makes it so well, is that it is a legal constitutional process. And the other point that he made, which I think is an important one, is that policymakers take a constitutional oath. They are required to follow the Constitution. So the history, the precedents, the analysis, they are obliged to take it into account. There have been three prior impeachments of presidents. There have been numerous federal judges over the last 200 years that have impeached. This is a solemn, serious, and sad process. But it's one that people need to take seriously and not view exclusively through the prism of partisan politics.
So let me ask you a legal question then. Besides high crimes and misdemeanors, the Constitution, and people forget this, specifies treason and bribery as the only two named crimes. Does the evidence that we have, or let's say to take Cass's premise at the beginning that the evidence is inconclusive so far and they're still investigating. If the evidence demonstrates that Trump bribed the president of Ukraine with military aid or a White House meeting, then the vagaries of high crimes and misdemeanors, that phrase, don't matter. We would have a crime specifically named in the Constitution, bribery. Are we headed toward that potentially for you as a lawyer?
Well, Professor Sunstein is the expert, so I think those kinds of questions you should put to him. But the first question you asked me is the one that I'm most profoundly interested in, which is educating the public and the profession about this process so we all take it thoughtfully and seriously.
Cass, if the evidence demonstrates that the president was offering military aid or a White House meeting to President Zelensky in exchange for investigating the Bidens and the 2016 election, would that be bribery under the meaning of the Constitution?
Well, treason is defined in the Constitution specifically, and it wouldn't be treason. Treason means we have to be at war with a country, and we're not at war with Ukraine. They're not an enemy. Bribery would standardly involve the president being paid money in order to support a law, or the president paying money in order to get a law. If the president is offering some inducement in order to get a foreign leader to do something, whether it's bribery is a very reasonable question. I think we wouldn't have to get there, because if something like that happened, as I said, I think it's good to be, you know, continuing to understand exactly what the conversation entailed. There, we're very much in the domain of the misdemeanor, the high misdemeanor within the meaning of the Constitution. I think the president, by the way, hasn't yet disagreed with that legal proposition, and his and the White House's insistence that there was no quid pro quo can be taken as suggesting, and this is, I think, a good thing, at least provisional agreement on the constitutional standard.
Barbara in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Barbara.
Oh, hello. Thank you. This is a question for Mr. Greenberg. I'm wondering, with all his obvious ethical issues, why does Rudy Giuliani still have a license to practice law from the state of New York?
Well, first of all, let me say that the New York State Bar Association has no authority or jurisdiction over disciplinary or grievance matters. That's handled by the courts. All I would say in response to your question is that matters such as the ones you've raised in our country, where the rule of law applies, requires fact-finding, investigation, even handed and neutral application of legal principles to facts that are found. So making judgments about a person's license or status as a professional based on accounts in the media, however well-founded and grounded, is not how we apply the rule of law to licensed professionals.
Well, we hear now, and Barbara, thank you for your call, we hear now that Rudy Giuliani may be under investigation for potential crimes, maybe lobbying crimes on behalf of foreign interests, the specific Ukrainians he's been working with. How much legal trouble and of what kind specifically might Rudy Giuliani be in your opinion? How do you understand, Henry, the investigation?
Well, Brian, I know what you know, which is I've read news accounts, and that's all I know. So I'm not, and I don't think it would be prudent or responsible for me to make judgments just based on headlines. So I'm not going to speculate about what the status of the investigation is, or even if there is an investigation that's ongoing.
Cass, what do you make of the Rudy Giuliani factor and how much trouble he may be in with these reports that he himself may be under investigation for the things that his associates were indicted for last week?
Well, let me say something general and then I'll get to the particular. I think the people are, you know, very agitated, and that's part of the way we govern ourselves, to be agitated. I think it's right to be agitated about many of the things that are going on. We're all agitated. In terms of thinking about the Constitution and law, to be taking a deep breath and behind some sort of veil of neutrality is a good idea. And I think for Giuliani, the allegations are, you know, they range from the preposterous to the quite serious. I think that his own, you know, future is a matter of some relevance, surely. What the president did and exactly why is the, you know, the really large question. And it's possible Giuliani did something that will put him in legal trouble. I think all of us should hope not necessarily because we love him, but because it's best for people who are working for the president not to violate the law.
Kathleen in Harlem.
An election.
You're on WNYC. Kathleen, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What you got?
Can you hear me?
I can. Can you hear me?
I can, yes. Gentlemen, how are you?
Very good, thank you.
Okay, I would like to know, why is it okay that the United States meddles in other countries' elections? I believe, I'm not 100% sure, but the diplomat that was just fired, I believe it's the same diplomat that there is a recording of and video of herself and another U.S. personnel speaking on a line. I think it was the chocolate guy, Medvedev, from Ukraine. And they wanted, the United States wanted Medvedev to get elected. You can hear them, making all kinds of backhand deals to get him in. And then there's a video of her passing out bread, and the Ukrainians want nothing to do with her. There was an article written by Scott Shane from the New York Times, dated February 17, 2018, titled, "Russia isn't the only one meddling in elections. We do it too." And if you read the article, you know, it goes on to say why this is not a bad thing. So we do it. Countries do it to us. Why is Trump being taken to task for something that, you know, this was under Obama, that Obama clearly did?
And if you're going to make that argument, not just Obama, but all the way back to so many instances during the Cold War, and Trump actually reportedly said this to Putin, you know, don't worry about that. We do the same thing. So, Cass, what would you say about that?
Well, if the candidate for the presidency, to make it, you know, more neutral, let's suppose it's a Democrat, works with China to procure the presidency in the United States, that's an impeachable offense. That's clearly a violation of what the framers were trying to make a violation, so you can't do that. If the president of the United States tries to get reelected, let's suppose it was Obama, by conspiring with Russia to try to get Romney in trouble, that would be an impeachable offense. If the president of the United States tries to get, let's say, Trump prosecuted by some foreign country for alleged wrongdoing there, that's not allowed. That's not part of our system. So there's our own capacity for self-government that's at risk, and I think that is importantly our focus. If the United States meddles in some way in a country that doesn't respect freedom, then that raises serious questions, I think, on all sides of the political spectrum. It might be an admirable thing to do. Maybe we're trying to save lives. It might be an illegitimate thing to do. Maybe we're trying to impress ourselves in a country that is functioning fine. But these are extremely separate questions, and it's probably a good idea to avoid in this really important context, whataboutism.
But, and this is a whataboutism question, I guess. Kathleen's point is, if it's okay for the U.S. to have a foreign policy that prefers one candidate over another in another country and makes that clear explicitly or through back channels in those countries, why isn't it okay for another country to have and express its vested interest in our elections, especially with the U.S. being the only superpower in the world.
You're completely right. So if Russia wants one or another candidate, or China thinks it would be better off with one, they're perfectly allowed to do that. There are legal restrictions on their ability to interfere with our campaign. Our own legal restrictions apply. And it's not really an act of war, but it's in the same universe of an act of war if there's an effort by another country to elect their own preferred person. I say the universe, meaning it's an expression of enmity, and it's not something that we can tolerate. That's not a claim for military force, I hasten to add. And if our own domestic people, let's say, I'll just make run a name, Senator Sanders, invites foreign interference with our process in order to get himself elected, I believe Senator Sanders has never done that, and good for him to do that would be entirely illegitimate, would violate our process of self-government. And if Russia doesn't merely express its view, but uses the social media and internet in a way that is covert and evasive of our law, and even if it is isn't evasive of our law, it's merely covert, it's compromising our capacity to govern ourselves.
Can you give us your take on the impeachment news likely to come this week? We have Trump's former Russia envoy or advisor, Fiona Hill, testifying today. It seems she's not likely to take the White House party line. And Gordon Sondland, the Trump donor and Oregon hotel owner who got made ambassador to the EU and consulted the president on the rising concerns of a quid pro quo being offered to Ukraine. What are you looking for from either?
Well, that great Yankee, Yogi Berra, said predictions are tough, especially about the future. And that applies to the ongoing, very volatile days and weeks. I would predict, notwithstanding Yogi Berra's wisdom, that it's not going to be a great week for the White House, that at least it's going to get a tick or two more troublesome from the standpoint of those who are concerned about use of foreign officials to interfere with our electoral process.
The Yankees could have used a catcher who hits like Yogi Berra last night, but that's another show. The Washington Post reports Sondland will say things like, he only told our Ukraine ambassador, Bill Taylor, there was a quid pro quo after the president gave him those words. So how much do you get the sense Sondland will say there really was no quid pro quo because the president told him to say that, saying that as a Trump loyalist spinning, you know, the president told me that himself, it must be true, versus I didn't really believe it. It looked like a quid pro quo to me. But my job is just to pass Trump's cover his backside words to Ambassador Taylor.
Well, it would be very surprising if he spoke in exactly those terms. It would be more likely if he said, if the current reports are accurate, I was saying what the president told me to say. I was following orders. But my own view is agnostic on whether there was a quid pro quo. That would be concerning. But it wouldn't be like a knife in the president's back. It would be much worse if he said, given the context, I believe there was a quid pro quo. If he said that, that wouldn't be quite a knife, but if he had evidence supporting it, that would be a very tough thing for the White House to handle.
Henry Greenberg is president of the New York Bar Association. Do you have any take on the local legal procedures going on with respect to Trump? I'm thinking particularly of the Manhattan DA looking for the tax returns in the hush money investigation.
I've just read the same newspaper accounts that you have, Brian, but I will say, since we're referring to Yogi, it does feel like deja vu all over again. You and I are old enough where we can recall the Nixon impeachment process, the Clinton impeachment process. And I'm struck by a feeling of the solemnity of it all and the sadness of it all as we watch it unfold day to day, drip by drip, all of these developments. So like you, I'm watching with great interest.
So tomorrow night, you will be talking to Cass at the Fordham University Law School at 6 o'clock. We should say that that's at 150 West 62nd Street. That's that Fordham campus. It's not the one in the Bronx. West 62nd between Columbus and Amsterdam. What can people expect if they go?
They can expect the sort of erudition and scholarship and thoughtfulness that we heard this morning from Professor Sunstein. He is the best of the best, as you said. He's one of our great public intellectuals and a preeminent expert on impeachment, and we're grateful that he's going to favor us with his time and expertise.
And Cass, before you go, can I ask one question relevant to your position in the Obama administration as administrator of the White House Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs? I don't know how much that meant you got into the nuts and bolts of regulation. But President Trump says, and if he gets to run for re-election, he'll certainly be running on promises kept with respect to massive deregulation since he's been in office. I'm curious if there's anything regarding that you've had your eye on as a real dramatic change from the Obama years, for better or worse?
Well, the president has not issued a ton of new regulations. So he succeeded in slowing the flow of new ones. I think a Democrat would have been also cautious about new regulations, because we in the Obama administration, we looked wherever it would make sense to try to do one, and the ones that we didn't do didn't make sense. So I wouldn't have expected to see a ton in these years. The notion that we've seen massive deregulation, let's call that fake news. We've seen some deregulation. Most of the ones on the book, the overwhelming majority, have been kept on the books, and a lot of them have been quietly reaffirmed. The ones that have been taken away, in some cases, are ones that shouldn't have been taken away. And I'm thinking of climate change regulations in particular. That's the area where President Trump has been genuinely aggressive in taking away regulations. And if you like cars with bad fuel economy, you should be applauding, because if he gets his way, we're going to have a lot more cars with bad fuel economy.
Cass Sunstein, Harvard Law School professor and author of Impeachment, A Citizen's Guide, and Henry Greenberg, president of the New York State Bar Association and partner at Greenberg Traurig. Thank you both so much.
Thank you, Brian.
Thanks a lot.